Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, August 20th. Done deal? We hear from a financial analyst about the proposed Hawaiian Airlines and Alaska Airlines merger. At this hour, the State Water Commission takes up the discovery of a new class of chemicals in a shuttered Aiea water well. A University of Hawaii geochemist takes a closer look. The contaminants are said to be commonly found in an urban environment, and he says asphalt could be a likely source. We check in on the progress to find a new landfill site on Oahu now that the Waipio soccer field is no longer in the running. The Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement gives us an update on modular housing for Maui fire survivors. And we learn about a workshop for reef-friendly landscaping offered by the Maui Nui Marine Resource Council. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Department of Justice will not block the merger between Hawaiian Airlines and Alaska Airlines. To many, it seemed like the department's investigation went out with a whimper by letting the time period for an antitrust investigation expire. And questions remain about next steps. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Ruben Miller this morning. Miller is the executive editor of CTFN, a news service for investors.
I wanted to start with the timing and this announcement, this deadline that passed yesterday. It felt almost anticlimactic after waiting, hearing that it would be, 6:01 p.m. and then kind of not hearing much from anyone. So is that typically how these deadlines pass?
It's funny that it's a whimper, not a bang, and especially in a very contentious situation like this where it really could have gone either way. To see it just kind of clear, it is strange just to see stroke of a clock, there's no action, and the runway is looking clear. That is how the process is designed, though. When the government clears a merger without taking any action, whether that be filing a suit to oppose the transaction or seeking commitments or remedies, they would generally have to file those, and then we'd see something. When it's just outright clearance, as this is mostly, it just goes out with a whimper, not a bang, and it is anticlimactic.
And to me, what's interesting is then the DOJ, the Department of Justice, filing for these extensions. So, now it makes you think, what were they looking for?
Even that part isn't as clear as it could be. We don't actually know if it was the Department of Justice seeking more time to get their ducks in a row or to continue their investigation, or exactly whether it was the government or the merging parties that sought that additional time. That's unclear to us, and we may never know. I mean, at this point, we don't know whether it was the merging parties saying, we want a last chance to explain the merits of our merger, or we're willing to offer XYZ commitments to get you, the Department of Justice, more comfortable, or whether it was the Department of Justice saying, we are prepared to launch this lawsuit, we have these lingering issues, please come in and explain that away to us. But what we have seen in the releases, both from Alaska, from the Hawaii governor, from a statement that we got from the Hawaii Attorney General, is that there was some commitments that were offered or committed to by the merging parties, but those aren't codified in a legally binding document emanating from the Department of Justice. We may still see some kind of remedy or some kind of commitments that are legally binding when we get the Department of Transportation decision on the matter. So that's kind of taking this one or two steps forward. But this merger isn't free and clear. It's not ready for takeoff quite yet because the Department of Transportation can come back and give this a thumbs up or give it a thumbs down. So the merger is looking like it's going to occur, but it is not a done deal yet.
I saw early reports from CTFN from your and your staff's reporting that there were talks of DOJ potentially filing a lawsuit. So it's tough to speculate, but what could have changed, or maybe what are the different priorities that regulators were juggling here?
Well, that's the really interesting question here, because this was a fairly unique process. In this matter, it really appears that as of early August, right, with the initial August 5th deadline, it very much appeared to us that the Department of Justice was lining up to sue this. We believe the staff of the Department of Justice had issued a recommendation to their leadership to sue this. And it's our belief that as of August 3rd, August 4th, there was an impending lawsuit. Something changed at that point, as you allude to. And we're kind of entering speculative land here. But kind of at that point, we start seeing this major surge of political cover for the merger. Governor Green sent letters to the Department of Transportation and the Department of Justice in support of the merger, as did Governor Inslee from Washington. You know, fast forward a couple days from that early August period, and we saw numerous letters from labor organizations and local groups in Hawaii. So I think the speculation now is around kind of political advocacy that successfully redirected the path of the Department of Justice here, who we believe was ready to sue this transaction. And that shift may have occurred on a political level and less on a regulatory level.
I was curious how much of the decision-making seemed to rely on kind of a failing firm defense. So to say that Hawaiian Airlines specifically is losing market shares, being pushed out by a competitor like Southwest, and that letting the merger go forward would make the landscape more competitive.
Yeah, though that's a really interesting point. And, you know, it's been used previously. And to some degree, it was used in the unsuccessful Spirit Airlines JetBlue merger. But there's some unique attributes to Hawaiian Air that really, I think, activated the political cover that it received, right? There's kind of different theories about failing firms versus flailing firms. And the failing firms defense is a very technical, we are about to go into bankruptcy, lose these assets, they will exit the market. Flailing firms is a little bit different. And I think that's where you put Hawaiian Air, in that, okay, in 2 years and 5 years, will they continue to operate with the same activity levels as they have been presently? Can they keep up the same activity as far as routes? Can they maintain employees and employee benefits to the same degree? And I think that's where Governor Green and others took a hard look at this and said, maybe there's some merger to monopoly issues in trans-Pacific flights, but as far as intra-island flights, we, the community of Hawaii, is dependent on Hawaiian Air to get us from island to island. And we need Hawaiian Air to be healthy, and this is the best route forward.
In terms of those next steps, in terms of that timeline, how long does Department of Transportation have?
It's a pretty esoteric filing with the Department of Transportation. Anytime there's a change of ownership or a change of license or a merging of routes, they have to make a filing with the DOT and the FAA to get that approval. What Alaska has sought here is an exemption, which would allow the companies to merge in practice for shareholders to get paid while the DOT completes that lengthy review. So filing for the exemption would allow them to merge for shareholders to get paid and kind of end the drama. There are not a lot of great precedents for this. Alaska filed for one in 2016 when they bought Virgin America, and I believe it took them around 4 months to get that, and that it came out kind of synced up with the conclusion of the Department of Justice review. In this current matter, we saw Alaska make that filing just last month, in July 16th. So there's no statutory timeline for the Department of Transportation to respond to Alaska, whether to say exemption granted, go ahead and start moving your chess pieces around the board, or exemption not granted, we're going to take 6 months or 8 months to do a more in-depth review here. We just don't know when that decision date's going to come. And there's not a lot of precedent for us to look at. So that's where Wall Street is very interested in right now, is what does that Department of Transportation response look like for the exemption that was filed July 16th?
And you mentioned earlier kind of the importance of Hawaiian Airlines here in the islands. I think one of the big questions on the ground as well is whether these two companies' commitments to maintaining separate brands, whether that will actually follow through if this merger goes forward. So is there anything in any of these filings that would essentially force these two airlines to maintain distinct brands?
It's a good question. Maintaining distinct brands is one aspect of this, and arguably less important, right? I think some of the commitments are around capacity commitments. Mm-hmm. Has Alaska committed to flying the same number of routes intra-island? Have they committed to maintaining the same workforce? Those are some of the more kind of substantive commitments that we're seeing alluded to in Governor Green's press release, in your attorney general's statements, in Alaska's filings. So we're seeing these allusions to these commitments, but it's unclear what the legal mechanisms are to enforce those. So, you know, at this point, it's unclear both for capacity commitments, employee retention rates, and the branding. It's unclear how those are going to be codified and enforced. It may be through the Department of Transportation's approval process. It may be some kind of memorandum between the governor or the attorney general's office and the merging parties. But at this point, I don't think we know exactly how those are going to be formalized.
That was Ruben Miller, executive editor of CTFN, talking with HBR's Maddie Bender. When reached for comment, the governor's office pointed us to a statement that was released yesterday, reading in part, by the joining of these two airlines, a stronger company will emerge and offer more travel options for Hawaii residents and local businesses, and will enhance competition across the U.S. airline industry. The next step for Hawaiian-Alaska Airlines merger is approval from the U.S. Department of Transportation of the interim exemption application.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
This Saturday night on The Real Deal, the music of Leonard Bernstein. From Billie Holiday and Tony Bennett to the Stan Kenton Orchestra featuring Gabe Baltazar. Hope you can join me, Seth Marco, this Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Telcom, now offering Fioptics Plus TV service statewide, giving neighbor island families a choice in TV providers. HawaiianTel.com/Fioptics Plus.
This morning, the State Water Commission is taking up the discovery of a new class of contaminants in a well the earlier this summer. It's the same well that the Board of Water Supply shut down at the end of 2021 after a fuel leak from the Red Hill fuel tanks. The Navy also discovered it in its sampling of underground monitoring wells just below the now-empty Red Hill facility. So could the contaminants be from the military facility or somewhere else? Don Thomas is with the University of Hawaii School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology. The geochemist has been taking a closer look at both the Board of Water Supply sampling and the Navy's underground monitoring wells, which is just above our drinking aquifer. The detection of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, was at higher concentrations in the board sampling and lower in the military's tests. They can be found in petroleum products like diesel or gasoline. Here's Thomas.
Where they're present, I think most commonly that we come in contact with them is actually in the asphalt in the road. The asphalt that is used in the road building material is kind of the residual material from the distillation of gasoline and kerosene and all of the other lighter volatiles. But what's left behind is this very thick, gummy, very high molecular weight mixture of material that has been used going on a century now or more for road building. And we've also learned that these compounds are actually generated by the combustion of the lighter fuels. When it's refined, it segregates the different groups of compounds. Crude oil is pretty thick and gummy stuff that's made up of both light hydrocarbons and heavier hydrocarbons. And the whole refinery industry is all about separating those different fractions into compounds that we use in everyday life.
So if these compounds are turning up in the water, we need to know what its footprint is. Is it something right. that's been processed or refined, or is it just the natural crude oil?
Right.
And so this theory that it may be coming from Red Hill, from either old spills or what was there before that's in our water, you're not feeling comfortable with that theory.
Well, what we had to do and what I have started doing since I became aware of the findings was to look at the different compounds that were present. And it's called forensics. Essentially, what we're trying to do is fingerprint the compounds that are present in the wells out in the Halawa'aya area and compare, so to speak, those fingerprints with the fingerprint of the fuels that have been released at Red Hill. And, you know, compare those. And it's important, again, I don't want to underemphasize the importance of understanding where these are coming from. Because if it becomes a problem, if concentrations get high enough that they're above the acceptable contaminant levels in the water, then somebody's going to have to do something to fix it. So we got to figure out what the source is first. And once we understand what the source is, then we can take whatever remediation actions need to be taken in order to fix the problem. So for me, as a scientist, my first question is, okay, where does this stuff come from? What is the source? And I looked at the compounds that Ernie Lau had presented in the analysis of the water from the Aya well and compared those compounds to similar compounds present in the Navy well and compare those and see if it's possible for the contaminants that are being seen in the Aya well is coming from the releases that occurred at the Red Hill facility. And sort of looking at the individual compounds, what I'm finding is that that doesn't appear to be very likely.
Well, I mean, there's a lot that we don't know about the flow, I guess, and the modeling. I mean, I understand that right. there have been some discussions for a couple of years now.
Well, it's been about 10 years.
10 years. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, we just don't know. And, you know, and so minds are coming together to try and find some plausible explanation for what's going on. So I guess that's right. part of the problem.
We have a group at the university right now that is working on trying to develop a model of groundwater flow in this region. And we're doing a lot of investigations on the geologic structures present in the area. We're looking at sort of the naturally occurring tracers in the groundwater and trying to use those to tell us, okay, where is this water coming from? And get some sense of how water is flowing through that area beneath Red Hill. And we've made a lot of progress. We're not there yet, but made a lot of progress in understanding the water flow.
I know Ernie said that this whole idea of some sense of urgency, he says that's an understatement. He really is concerned about what's the worst that could happen.
Yes,
and
yes.
He wants to err on the side of caution, understandably. But at the same time, you know, there are folks who probably think, well, let's not jump to conclusions because we need to understand really what is happening.
Exactly. And, you know, until we understand what the source of the contamination is in the IAO wells, we don't really have a way of fixing it. If it has a source closer to the IAO wells, then something has to be done there, not at Red Hill. And in fact, you know, the data that and the analysis of the data that I've done, it looks more likely that the source is closer to the IAO wells than the Red Hill releases.
You know, this idea that if you put dye in the water to be able to know where the flow is?
That is something that we intend to do. We have not done that yet. As I say, we're looking at the naturally occurring tracers. We're actually making direct measurements of water flow through the wells that are in the vicinity of Red Hill. And once we have that information, we can then make a sort of a more informed design of a dye tracer study. One of my colleagues in the USGS, I believe, was quoted as saying that the standard dye tracer study in Hawaii is you pump the dye in and then you never see it again. This is a problem we'd like to avoid. We'd like to get as much information about water flow directions and rates before we put the dye in the water so that we have a pretty good idea where to look for it during that transport process.
It's kind of a mystery.
It's a very open question.
Yeah.
And I like to point out that there were two very well-respected hydrogeologists who have written papers on groundwater flow in the Red Hill area, and their conclusions on direction of flow were different by 90 degrees. So it is still very much an open question. We have not figured this out. It's a geologically very complicated region, and it is difficult to know exactly how water is moving through that system. You know, I try to go where the data takes me, and the data, you know, really tells me that it's unlikely to the point of being impossible that what is being seen at the IOLs is coming from Red Hill. We're seeing concentrations of some of these compounds higher in the IOLs than are actually present directly below Red Hill. And there's no way that can happen, you know, with just direct transport from Red Hill to IAO.
That was Don Thomas, geochemist, weighing in on the latest contaminants found in sampling conducted by the Board of Water Supply and the Navy. The military is to hold a public meeting on the Red Hill tank cleaning tomorrow at the Moanalua Terrace Community Center. What to do about Oahu's trash and the need for a new landfill? It's been 4 months since the Waipio soccer field was eliminated as an option. HPR reporter Ashley Mizuo joins us this morning to get us updated on where things stand. So the Blanchiardi administration really had to go back to the drawing board.
Right, yeah, and I think they just went back to the Land Use Commission to get approval to extend the time that they would have to find a new site for Waimanalo Gulch to the end of this year. Originally, that was set for 2022, but the Blanchiardi administration blew through that, asking the Land Use Commission for an extension, I think just a few days before they were supposed to hit that 2022 deadline. And then they've been going back and forth with it unresolved until just recently, about a week ago. And then they're doing the final hearing on that later this week. But they got the initial approval to go to the end of the year to find this new site. You know, back in 2019, the city was ordered to close Waimanalo Gulch by 2028. And in the past, the city has said it would take 7 years to find a new landfill. One of the big hiccups, though, to finding this new site is in 2020, the legislature passed a law commonly now referred to as Act 73, and it bars landfills from being in a state conservation district, and it must be at least half a mile from any resident, school, or hospital. So that's narrowed the amount of areas that the city can find to site this new landfill. And then on top of that, they did narrow it down to 6 locations that satisfied that Act 73 requirement. But they were all in the Board of Water Supply's what they call a no-pass zone, which the department says in a landfill in that area can threaten groundwater. So taking that into account, the city's landfill advisory committee rejected all of those sites, all 6 of those, back in 2022. And then the city has tried to get permission from the Navy to use land near Pearl Harbor, which is the YPO soccer field, which was highly controversial. But in the end, the Navy rejected that request earlier this year. Honolulu E&V Director Roger Babcock said the city is now considering other options.
We are looking at the things that essentially our landfill advisory committee recommended, which was to look at military land possibilities with respect to modifying or repealing Act 73, and then looking at eminent domain, perhaps purchasing some properties that would maybe free up some space because of the residential restrictions. So perhaps buying some property to then use as a landfill space. So we are actively looking still at all of those things.
Yeah, but repealing that is not going to be very popular.
Right, yeah. And the lawmakers I spoke to are just not really that into re-adjudicating the whole Act 73 thing. Here's Senator Kurt Favela and Representative Cedric Gates, who both worked on the legislation for Act 73, and they represent the Westside communities that live near Wamanala Gulch.
Nobody wants a landfill in their backyard at all. I told them at the meeting, I am not entertaining, modifying, nothing.
I feel that we can come up with innovative ways to replace the landfill, and I hope that's the direction we head. Instead of trying to repeal the legislation that we created through collaborations with our community. And it was a very contentious issue, obviously, for many reasons, but I believe that the community won at the end of the day.
And, you know, they both want to see that landfill closed to give Westside residents relief from housing the city's trash. The Westside of Oahu also houses PVT landfill, which is where industrial waste also goes.
So bring us up to speed. What's the life of the Wamanala Gulch these days?
Yeah, it really varies year to year. So Wamanala Gulch accepts about 220,000 tons of waste a year. Most of it is ash and residue from H-Power, the waste-to-energy incinerator. Babcock says the lifespan of Wamanala Gulch goes up and down based on the amount of trash going into the landfill and then the space available at the landfill. So in 2022, the city estimated that there was about 13 years capacity left, and that was a record year for them. They had the least amount of trash go into Wamanala Gulch that year, and so the lifespan was really long of Wamanala Gulch. But in 2023, that was reduced to about 8 years.
That was because of some additional downtime of H-Power, so that meant there was more refuse diverted last year than there had been in several years. So it's kind of a higher rate of material having to go to the landfill instead of getting burned at H-Power and then just put the ash. So there's a 90% reduction. So if you take municipal solid waste and put it in the landfill, that takes up a certain amount of space. But if you burn it first, then the ash only takes up 10% of the space. So that's the benefit of having H-Power. It makes the landfill last 10 times longer, right? So if you have a not too good of a year in terms of our ability to burn trash due to some downtime of and repairs needed at H-Power, then that reduces the remaining life.
Yeah, and so he expects the lifespan to increase next year with H-Power up and running. And this is a key thing, which is that H-Power's contract with the city also requires the city to have a landfill in case of H-Power breaking down and to accept that residue and ash that comes out of it. So when people say that they would prefer to not have a landfill, all the reason the city must have one is because of this contract that it has with H-Power. Babcock added that the city is also about 3 years away from completing another waste project that would recycle ash from H-Power into sand and to use as asphalt. That would reduce the incinerator's output by about 75%. And I guess the state also imports all of its sand. So it could help, you know, to have it not constantly having to import the sand and using this recycled ash instead for part of it.
Yeah, seems like a good idea. But, you know, and I remember when they expanded H-Power and put in that third boiler. But, yeah, if it goes down, you got to put the trash somewhere.
Right, right. And I think even, you know, when we're looking at the way that we're consuming trash, they've tried to do different things to limit the amount of trash going into the landfill, like, you know, the plastic ban and things like that. But we don't have an industrial composting facility. And so, you know, all of that trash that is compostable plastic can't really be composted. So it just goes to H-Power anyway. It's the city's intention to comply with the commission's deadlines, including that 2028 closure. The Land Use Commission has given the city that initial approval to take until the end of the year to find a new site. Babcock said that they're not starting from scratch and they're not going to be looking for, or not necessarily going to be looking for, a bunch of new locations within that time. They're trying to work within the parameters that they were given. In the past, they have considered, of the six locations, their top choice was Kunia. There was another one in Waipahu, three in Wailua, and one in between Haliva and Wailua. So that's kind of the different areas that they're looking at. The Land Use Commission has encouraged the Board of Water Supply to also consider looking at the sites in the no-pass zone to see if it really would impact groundwater and threaten drinking water specifically. So that's what they're looking at. And Representative Gates, who is currently running for a West Side Senate seat, says he's giving Mayor Rick Blangiardi, who just won re-election, the benefit of the doubt.
He gave us his word, and we'll see what comes out when we get to 2028. But we do got to move fast because it's not going to be an easy build-out.
And 2028 will bring us to the end of Mayor Blangiardi's term as mayor.
Yeah, this is one of those issues we keep going round and round and round.
Yeah.
It's like the natatorium and, you know, Falls of Clyde. It's just like, oh my gosh, make a decision, please.
Exactly, yeah. And I think they're just really stuck kind of in trying to navigate these different parameters and find this new site to open. It's not necessarily the closing. It's looking for this new site that's been the issue.
Yeah, and I know the Blangiardi administration has been really working with the military to see, yeah, are there any other lands that could free up that, you know, could possibly work, you know, that they
right.
don't need and we could certainly use. But yeah, it does take a while for them to get back.
Yeah, definitely. Going back and forth, trying to negotiate these things can take a really long time. And then also, you know, there's so much public opposition to having a landfill in your area. We see, you know, people would probably protest. You don't want to live next to the landfill. And I know the West Side communities have been extremely upset about having Wamanala Gulch and PVT in their backyard for so
long. And then, yeah, there are always impact fees or ways to be able to try and even out, you know, shouldering that burden.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not an easy fix. But thank you so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
We've been talking to HPR's Ashley Mizuo about the search for a new landfill here on Oahu.
Jaron Duran of the Boston Red Sox was suspended for 2 games for using a homophobic slur.
I don't think that my actions should represent what the team and MLB represent. It was just a bad moment on my part, and I'm owning up to it and apologizing for it.
The struggle for major sports with LGBTQ inclusion. I'm Tiziana Deering. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
Housing for Maui wildfire survivors is top of mind as we work to recover from last year's disaster. The state is building 450 units in its Kala'i'ula Park project, and next door, FEMA's Kilohana development will consist of another 169 units. The Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement is also in on the mix, aiming to construct a total of 66 modular units spread across 2 projects, one in Lahaina Luna and one in Central Maui. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with the council CEO, Kuhia Lewis, about the interim housing taking shape on the Valley Isle.
CNHA is absolutely doing a number of programs. We're housing people in direct leases. So we've rented units and sublet it to survivors. We're building homes right now. But the state has done a significant amount of lifting as well. They're building hundreds of units. They've purchased and acquired buildings that could help house people. And we are in communication. We're collaborating. You know, Hawaii Community Foundation has played a critical role as well. I mean, their funding is really, if it wasn't for those partners and even the county helping us navigate the permitting process, we wouldn't be where we are. And I'll say, like, for example, the units that CNHA are building, we're building some in Maui Lani, we're building some in Lahaina. We're building 2 bedrooms because the data told us that's the average family size. We're allowing animals in these units for them to have pets because that was the biggest need, is nobody wanted to rent to them because they had animals. So we're literally building our programs based on the data that we're collecting directly from survivors.
With the speed at which these units are being built, it's much faster than if you were to fabricate a house from scratch, of course, but there is kind of a delay in what you're setting out to do when it's finally completed and when people can move in. And so what if the needs change in the 6 or so months it takes?
Well, the good thing about these homes, and yes, this has been a big lift. I mean, you don't see this kind of mobilization, in Hawaii. These houses are needed. They were needed before the fire, to be honest. We had a housing crisis before the fire. So whether it's housing teachers, whether it's workforce housing, there will be a need for this housing regardless. But the houses are being built for the purpose of housing survivors using money that we've raised for that purpose as well. So we want to make sure we hit the mark to the degree that we can. I feel confident that what is being built, whether it's the governor, whether it's CNHA, or whoever, I think the amount of units that are being built will satisfy the need. And I say that because the plan here is, initially the challenge was everybody was in hotels. So now they're in short-term rentals or they're in some one-year lease. They need to go somewhere, right? So these houses are being built in accordance to where they're currently living to prepare them for midterm support, which is what these houses are intended for. It's not long-term. These houses are not long-term. They are midterm support. So we're preparing for them to come out of those one-year leases into these more midterm housing options. And so these midterm houses that we are building, these modulars, these ADUs, they're intended to house them for up to 5 years. And the ultimate goal is to get them to something permanent, to get folks back on their land or to prepare the bigger market for permanency. So that's the phases. The first phase was we got to get them housed so that you put them, everyone went into a hotel. Then we took a little bit, but we got everybody into some form of rental. And now we're looking at 5-year options. And then ultimately it's back to permanent housing. And then a lot of these temporary houses, you know, it's to be decided what we're going to use it for, whether it's workforce development, whether it's supporting teachers. There's a number of options on the table. Kala'i Ola, which is the governor's project, there's no rent there. For the project that CNHA is building, it's very affordable. And in most cases, they're not paying anything because it's being subsidized by either government funds or private funds, but it is for Lahaina, it's $1,750 a month. And the reason why is there's costs. We're paying for utilities, we're managing the property, we're ensuring that anything goes wrong, that it's fixed. So it depends on the project. Some are very affordable or others are just no cost at all.
A lot of the times with mobile homes, with modular homes, those builds are actually less fire resistant than if there had been kind of a brick and mortar house in the same place. And that also because those modular units are typically closer together, that then also presents a fire risk. So what is kind of being done on the design and construction side to make sure that these units are going to withstand?
That's a big concern of ours too. Of course, they've been traumatized. And so making sure that the homes that we're putting them are fire resistant is important. So that's working with whoever you're acquiring the modular units from. I will say that you know, there were various efforts that were explored typically on the continent, and we've learned a lot, by the way, in terms of how recovery works, is they move in a bunch of mobile homes on wheels. You know, like they bring in these mobile homes and that's where they place people while everything gets sorted out. You know, that's not really feasible for Hawaii. Can you imagine thousands of mobile homes on the island? What would you do with them? Where would you put them? Or where would you even, after 5 years is up, so we had to be a little more creative and aggressive in the modular units. So that's why we are where we are. We've, you know, FEMA, CNHA, even the state, we did a huge assessment of all of the different modular options. And we ended up employing multiple modular companies just because they couldn't crank out the numbers that we needed. So everything's on the table. We're making sure that they're as safe as possible for these families as recovery efforts continue. If you think about it, a lot of the survivors from Lahaina or even Kula are actually living in long-term rentals that were likely would have gone to someone living in other areas, Kahului, and the market's just tied up. So you're going to see more and more generational living in a single house. So the fire has impacted the entire island, not just Lahaina and Kula, because there's no inventory for others to move into at this point. So the faster we can get these houses online, the more stable it becomes, not just for them, but for the rest of the county.
And to your point earlier about how Maui already had a housing crisis before the fires, do you see what CNHA is doing now as kind of like, you would have loved to do this earlier, but only now do you have the funding or like what, I guess, why now?
I didn't realize that 30% of our housing was short-term rentals on Maui. I think if I knew that, I think if we knew that, we would have spoken up a lot sooner and called for change. This fire in Maui has really opened everyone's eyes to some challenging policies and practices that have been in place that need to be addressed. And I think what it's doing is it's setting the path for the rest of the state to take a deep look at, you know, what's really going on and what we need to be doing in this moment to support ourselves and address the problems that we're all facing.
Yeah. There also is this body of research on interim housing following disasters. And what that research kind of shows is that people faced higher rates of psychological distress, that there's no real way if what they're doing is not for the long term, like there's no way to avoid that.
Yeah, there's no way around it. Then this is going to be a challenging recovery. It's far from over. Arguably, we're very much at the beginning of it. I will say that it is important for partners to be collaborating, working together to provide wraparound service. And that's happening. So that what happens simultaneously to us building houses is the what they call the DCMP, which is like a disaster care management program, is stood up. And they start to, as families are moving in, they start to work directly with them to understand their unique needs. Could be mental health, could be jobs, could be employment, could be training, it could be education, it could be schooling. So they provide they do an assessment of the needs of the survivor, and they start to support them. So it's happening. I can tell you this, that this was a wake-up call for everybody. We will be better prepared for the next disaster. There's no question. I understand it too, and from a community lens, how we could be more effective right out the door.
Well, Kuhio Lewis, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Kuhio Lewis, CEO of the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement. He spoke recently with HPR's Maddie Bender. The council is accepting applications for the two midterm housing projects, La'iku and Ka'au Maluhia. It is also administering a Maui of County pre-development grant to support homeowners in Lahaina and Kula with up to $15,000. Check our website for more information.
In the 90s, one of Ukraine's biggest celebrities was Virka Serduchka, the drag alter ego of comedian Andriy Danilka.
Serduchka has been associated with weddings, birthdays, and drunk outings.
The perfect foil for post-Soviet Ukraine, but what does war mean for this comedian? Virka Serduchka, plus today's top global headlines, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
As artificial intelligence continues to boom, AI companies are debating whether to make their models available.
That open source model is extremely valuable for anyone downstream who wants to use it to be able to develop a new product or a new application.
I'm Kai Rizdal, AI for All, That's next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Ever wonder about the gut biome for your soil in your backyard or front yard? Well, if you're like me, probably not. But should we give it some thought? Why? Well, because what you think is good for your soil could be not so good for our coral reefs. The Maui Nui Resource Council is offering a new workshop about reef-friendly landscaping. We talked to Jill Wirt about what to expect.
We have a reef-friendly landscaping program at Maui Nui Marine Resource Council, and we've had it for a couple of years now and done a variety of different programs within the RFL project. So we've done test plots utilizing a locally made soil amendment that essentially acts as a probiotic for soil that can act as a replacement for fertilizers, and it's all made here. We certify properties that are implementing these reef-friendly and organic practices on island as well. And then we created the reef-friendly landscaping certification course. So professionals, property managers, landscapers, they can take this course online, and we have it available for the month of September. It'll open on September 4th. And they go through 10 different subjects on how to implement these practices onto their properties. It can also go into home gardening as well. It's more catered to larger properties like resorts or golf courses, but you can also apply some of these at a smaller scale on your own property as well.
Well, you know, we did something recently with the folks out there on Oahu's North Shore, you know, looking to protect the reefs by the Marine Preserve, by Three Tables in Shark's Cove. And, you know, they were into planting native grasses to act as filters from runoff, which I thought was a great idea. But yeah, when you really think about the things that go into good design that you can implement onshore to protect offshore.
Of course, yeah, it's everything is connected, and we go through the different topics of understanding your place and what belongs there and what doesn't belong there, how to reduce water use. So that goes into, you know, planting things that are meant to be there and that are adjusted to the environment, utilizing compost and compost teas, using battery-powered equipment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and just how to design better and kind of using your landscape, looking at what's already there, understanding it, taking into account that everything is connected and what you put on land will ultimately end up in the ocean. So anything that we can do to minimize that is super important.
I mean, I've always heard that you use too much fertilizer. That's not good if it goes into the storm drain and then it goes out into the ocean and messes up the balance, right, of the yeah. algae in the area.
Correct. If you put too many nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, they can run off onto the reef and cause algal blooms, which then can reduce sunlight that the corals need for photosynthesis and cause fish die-offs as well. So we're really trying to reduce any amount of input of that as possible.
So the class is geared more toward then, like you said, landscapers, businesses that normally deal with onshore stuff.
Yeah, so we did one round of the course in May. It was kind of our test round and got a lot of really great feedback for it. We wanted to make it more accessible. So this is the completely, you know, asynchronous online format. So people can do it at their own time. And it really incorporates kind of a bit of everything like site analysis and design, utilizing your plant waste for compost, understanding native, exotic, and invasive plants. We have Malama Aina, so knowing how to take care of your place in terms of the Hawaiian cultural aspect. And it's geared towards people who maybe feel like there's a barrier on how to make this transition. So we're trying to condense this information, make it as easily accessible as possible so that people can take the first step in transitioning their property to reef-friendly. This is all online, so anyone from any island can take this course, and we welcome that. We would be excited to have that and incorporate any additional knowledge. We're always welcoming feedback and wanting to incorporate as much new information as we possibly can. So it's a very new program, and we're excited to continue launching it and making it better over time. But yes, it's welcome to anyone island-wide because it is completely online for the month of September.
Is the course modeled after something else that's being taught, you know, in another state?
Yes, there's the Northeast Organic Farming Association, and they actually have an entire Standards for Organic Land Care handbook. It's about 70 pages long. And what we found is that it's very catered towards the East Coast. And we wanted to make a course that was more geared and more relevant to Hawaii, because Hawaii is so unique. And I mean, a lot of this information is inherently what people have been practicing for generations, right? And caretaking for their land. And so how do we take the existing information from the East Coast and incorporate some of their stuff into a Hawaiian-based curriculum as well, and utilizing instructors that have been practicing this in Hawaii for years.
Gotcha. So tapping the indigenous knowledge.
Correct.
And so, do you have to come to this class with any particular background, or is it pretty much open to all?
It's open to all. Some background is, of course, always helpful, but we don't want to limit anyone who is interested in wanting to take the course. Part of the course is when you do take it, you become part of this network, right? So you have access to other people who have taken the course, and you have access to Maui Nui Marine Resource Council and any workshops we might host as part of the ReFriendly Landscaping Program. So you're getting access to more than just the course. It's a membership. It's a network that you join, and you have the support after the course moving forward.
And do you get special certification for having gone through this workshop?
Yes. So if you start applying everything that you've learned and you transition your property or wherever you are to a ReFriendly Landscaping property, you know, you've removed all of the chemicals, you're using battery-powered equipment, and you're not using fertilizers, then we would come in and do a complimentary audit for you and give you a certification. You can do silver or gold level. We have 3 properties that are certified currently, 1 more in the works, and so we'd love to bring more people into that certification program as well.
So it's kind of a good housekeeping, a seal of approval.
Yes.
Okay. And so it's everything from what? Like using fish emulsion versus chemicals that might be, more hazardous to reef health?
Yeah. So there are things like compost teas or biological soil amendments. So in your soil, you should have things like bacteria, protozoa, fungi, beneficial nematodes. And they're kind of like the healthy gut biome that you try to create in your own stomach. So you want your soil to have all of those little microbes as well. And they create and make nutrients more available to the plants. And when your plants are healthy, they are stronger, they are more able to fight off diseases and pests. And so we're really trying to boost the immunity of the plants. When your plants are not healthy, that's when pests start to come in. So a lot of these soil amendments, you start from the bottom and support from the bottom all the way to the top. You can also apply the biological amendments on the foliar, so on the leaves of plants, and that can also act as a pest treatment amendment as well, instead of spraying chemicals.
That was Jill Wirth with the Maui Nui Marine Resource Council talking about a new workshop it is offering that is described as reef-friendly landscaping. That workshop starts September 4th, but enrollment ends on September 3rd. We will have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website after the show. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we take a closer look at trauma related to temporary housing. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on our website, as well as on Google, Spotify, and Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.